Once again, take a moment to stretch up and settle in. This posture is born in between expansion and contraction. Expansively, the spine grows up to Father Sky like a tree. Contractively, everything else just hangs limp and loose, surrendering to the gravitational pull of Mother Earth, collapsing, contracting. We'll begin with an unrestricted focus range. Whatever comes or calls, if it's visual, note it as see. Likewise, hear, feel. If two or three come or call at the same time, just choose one to label and focus on. If nothing much seems to come up, then most likely there's visual rest, auditory rest, somatic rest, the body is relaxed. The head is quiet, the mental screen is blank, and so forth. So see the rest, hear the rest, feel the rest. Try to the best of your ability to let go of the ordinary ordering principle for a little while. It's legitimate, but for these practice periods, we're exploring another dimension. The ordinary ordering principle for the body is get comfortable and avoid discomfort. The new ordering principle is get clear and stay open. The ordinary ordering principle for the mind is get answers and avoid don't know. The new ordering principle is be clear and be open. What part is mental image? What part is mental talk? That's your clarity. And letting the thoughts come and go without push and pull, detached from their meanings, at least somewhat, if possible, that's your equanimity. So it turns out that even if the body is uncomfortable physically, emotionally, or even if the mind is in a state of confusion or not knowing, we can still be okay. Now, sometimes focusing in an unrestricted range can be delicious and rich. There's the richness of all of the modalities and themes. And the deliciousness is that you don't have to create anything or look for anything. You just sort of wait for experiences to come or call. On the other hand, sometimes working that broadly can be sort of overwhelming. A lot's going on at once. Sort of confusing, scattering. That goes away with practice, but there's another possibility. We can decide to restrict the focus range, to just focus on one kind of experience for a little while. That can be also interesting. We get a more detailed view, but it has its own challenges because now we have to let distractions arise in the background. We have to intentionally come back, actively come back to a certain range. Let's explore that for a little while. We're going to start with body. For the next few minutes, let anything visual or auditory, inner or outer, be in the background. Our interest will just be body. But with regards to the body, our interest will be any quality or any location that may come and call. So if you find yourself being pulled away from body, gently return. Totally give permission for visual and auditory to do whatever they want to do in the background. Be aware of how visual and auditory may impact on body, activating or deactivating, causing it to coagulate or flow. So for the next few minutes, we're going to stay with body. And the label, if you elect a label, will be just the word feel, which could refer to an inner activation, an emotional feel. Could be just a purely physical feel, touch of your clothes, touch of the air, pressures, pains. It could be that you're feeling flowing energy, or that you're feeling restful states, relaxed, reposed, and so forth. As long as it's in the body, regardless of its quality, could be pleasant, unpleasant, both, or neither. If it's in the body, it's a feel. And we're going to stay in the body for a little while. But with regards to the body, once, as long as we're in the body, then it's passive. Whatever comes or calls, you'll be pulled to this location, to that quality, and so forth. Mental images, mental talk, if your eyes were open, physical sight, certainly physical sounds, they're going to be there. Let them in the background. For the next few minutes, we're going to restrict our focus range to body events. But with regards to body, we'll be passive. It could be physical, emotional. It could be the rest states or the flow therein. Our label will be generic, feel. And we'll use it for all of those specific categories. So you may be aware of a lot of detail, what kind of feel it is, where it is, how intense it is. If so, fine. But the only required for the next few minutes is, one way or another, you're having a clear sense contact with something somewhere in body. Okay, good. Now, let's shift from body to auditory. It could be anything, herein, mental talk, here out, physical sound, here rest, mental quiet or physical silence, or it could be the energy flow occurring within any of those, vibration, undulation, an undercurrent of stirring. As long as it's in the auditory field, it's in our current focus range. Let body be in the background. Let visual be in the background. We're anchoring in auditory for just a few minutes. If you wish to label, the label is here. Remember, we don't label the labels. Or if you can do it with direct awareness, just moment by moment, contacting something auditory somewhere, then that's good enough. As you do this, body and visual will almost certainly arise. That's perfectly okay. Let them. They're in the background. But now for concentration, keep coming back to auditory. Okay, good. Now, once again, let's shift. Let's go to visual. You can do this with your eyes open or closed. With your eyes closed, you'll be aware of visual rest, the darkness and/or brightness in front of, behind your closed eyes. You could be aware of mental images, images of your surroundings, images of yourself, memory plan, fantasy imagery. The images may vanish instantly. They may be pretty ill-defined, but visual thought is such. There may be pixelation, undulation, swirling energy in front of, behind your closed eyes. So with eyes closed, there's still plenty to see. With eyes open, you could still have mental images or visual rest states, but you could also have the see out, the physical sights. Your eye moves from object to object. Each of those is a new external visual arising. So eyes open or closed or half open as you wish. Restrict your interest to visual experience for the next few minutes. The label is see. As you do this, auditory and somatic will certainly arise. Let them in the background. They may have an impact on the visual. For example, a sound may trigger a mental image, or a body event may trigger an image of that body part or that energy flow. These are all part of C. So for just a few minutes, we're going to restrict to the visual domain, mental image, physical sight, visual rest or the flow therein, in any of the above. Let auditory and somatic arise in the background, in the foreground. Keep coming back to visual of some form. We're doing focus on C. Okay, good. Now, look back. We worked broadly, unrestricted range, any and all experience. And then we intentionally restricted our focus range, first to just body, then just auditory, then just visual. The unrestricted approach has its challenges and it has its own deliciousness. The main challenge is, well, a lot can be happening at the same time. It initially can be a little overwhelming. There's a learning curve to deal with such a broad domain. The richness is, well, it's everything. If we elect to restrict in some way, we lose some of the richness, but it may be a little easier to focus, less to handle. On the other hand, We now have to deal with distractions. Other things arise that pull us away, and then we have to come back. Of course, the coming back to a restricted domain builds concentration. And there's nothing wrong with that. Perhaps you're drawn to just work with visual for a while, or just auditory, or just somatic. Or maybe you're drawn to work broadly as we first did, whatever comes up. It's all good. That gives you four choices with regards to focus range so far. We're going to practice formally for a few more minutes. Feel free to shift your posture if you wish. Feel free to stand in place and move around anytime you want, if you're sleepy or uncomfortable. Perfectly okay. But keep continuity of technique, meaning be aware, be clear. What is my focus range? Is it just visual, just auditory, just somatic, or everything? Does my strategy entail mental labels, or am I going to track with direct awareness without mental labels? Just the sequence, acknowledge, focus. It's all good. You decide. And then whatever that decision is in terms of what you're going to focus on and how you're going to focus, implement that. Remember, the magic is in the moment. It's not so much what you're focusing on, whether the range is broad or narrow. It's moment by moment with regards to your sensory target of that moment. To what extent is there that quality few seconds of concentration, clarity, equanimity? Unless, of course, things vanish instantly, in which case, good, insight into anicca, impermanence. As soon as you acknowledge, it's gone. No sooner is it born, but it dies. This is not a problem. This is the reality of the senses. It's all good. Okay, if you have not already done so, let's return to a seated posture and continue formal practice for just a couple more minutes. Continue to be clear. Is my focus range unrestricted? Everything? Or am I going to just be working with visual or just auditory, just somatic? Little smaller domain. The magic is in the moment. Whatever it is, it either immediately vanishes, which is insight into impermanence, or it sticks around long enough to have a conscious experience of mindfulness with it, being clear, focused, equanimous, quality moment with whatever that sense experience is. Over and over again, we'll be pulled to the ordinary ordering principle. I need to get comfortable. I need to get answers. Nothing wrong with that principle. It's certainly part of evolution, Darwin's gift. However, we humans have evolved to the point where we've discovered there's a deeper ordering principle. It could be described as get clear and stay open. But actually, at a very deep level, it boils down to be complete. So fully present to the moment that the somethingness of the moment dissolves into the doingness of pure consciousness. And that returns to the timeless, spaceless, dimensionless, absolute rest. Nirodha, cessation. Which then breaks apart again, creating the next arising, which then returns to the same nothing. If indeed there is some anchor point, it's the still point of the turning world, which has neither dimension nor position, and is the source of dimension, position, and duration. The unborn. Emptiness. Okay, good. Good work, folks. So as I mentioned, the tenor of the day, and it will be identical tomorrow, except you'll have more momentum, is we'll practice and then we'll talk a bit and then we'll practice some more. So we're going to have just a couple minutes for talking. Anything that you would like to bring up, either immediate experiences that you've been having in our practice, or just any kinds of questions germane to practice, its history, its issues, and so forth.
My question is about how do I know when I'm focusing deeply enough on a sensory experience? My experience is that a sensory event comes up, and then I note and label it, and then there are several others simultaneously, and I'm chasing them a little bit, trying to track my subjective experience. So my question is, how do I know when I'm focusing deeply enough, penetrating the experience enough, I guess soaking into it adequately?
Okay, that is an excellent question. Can everyone hear me? We're all good? Okay, so each approach to practice has its own internal structure, its own internal logic, so to speak. So I'm going to answer your question within the context of this particular technique and my particular way of working. So I was going to get to some of these issues anyway, eventually, so thanks for bringing it up. You mentioned that you were sort of somewhat chasing experiences because there's a lot happening and it's coming pretty quickly. So as a general principle with this particular technique, you don't have to chase after the experiences. The phrase I use is, it's okay to miss things. It's okay. That doesn't mean that it's not okay to catch every single thing, okay? If you're one of these people that wants to note like a machine gun, like a laser, like that, and just zap each single arising with awareness, as described, for example, in my friend Dan Ingram's book, which is his style of doing noting, okay? If that works for you, great. Go ahead and do it. But most people cannot note that rapidly. So for most of us mortals, those that don't have those twitch muscles that Gann and a few others have, okay, for the rest of us, it's okay to miss, okay? You don't have to drive yourself crazy trying to get every single thing. So if while you're staying with one thing, a whole bunch of other things fly by unnoticed, that's okay. Secondly, if it, as I've said several times, but the question always comes up, well, what if it disappears instantly? Well, then by definition, you're not going to have that focus phase. You're going to only have the brief acknowledging. So no, there's not the time to soak in with it. But on the other hand, you're getting insight into gone and impermanence, so that's just fine. Let's say that you understand it's okay to miss, and but you still want to have a little more quality time. It seems like it isn't disappearing instantly, and I could do something more. If you wish to do something more, you can, but you're not required. A huge distinction in my approach is the difference between allowed and required. There are certain things that I'm going to require, but they're things anyone can do. So by definition, everyone can do my techniques perfectly. But then there's a bunch of options, stuff that's allowed if you want to up the ante. You can do it if you wish. So one thing you can do is during that focus phase, you can take a more active role to sort of pour your attention in or, quote, attempt to penetrate the object. Now that taking an active role, so getting a little technical here, as bear with me, it pays off. If you get the technical aspects down, you always know what to do. And so it's like science, it's like math, it's like, why all this detail and complexity and subtlety? But then when you sort of get it, it's like, okay, now I know exactly what to do. And equally important, I know exactly how to teach when the students ask me questions, because it's like, oh yeah, I asked that question and I see what the options are created to address these questions. So one thing you can do, but are not required to do, is be more active in how you thrust your attention towards the sensory target. Now, how many of you have ever heard of Upandita? Just curious. Okay, quite a few. Upandita is still alive, I hope, Mahasi Sayadaw's sort of heir apparent. Mahasi started the mental labeling tradition in Burma. So Upandita, his style makes a big deal about taking an active role during that focus phase. So I think of noting as typically involving a sequence, acknowledge, focus, acknowledge, focus, acknowledge, focus. Unless there's no time to focus because it disappears at the acknowledging. During the acknowledging phase, you have the option but not the requirement of mental labeling. During the focus phase, you have the option but not the requirement to intentionally thrust your attention into the sensory target. The traditional metaphor that Upandita would use is aim and fire. What I'm calling the knowledge phase, he would say that's like aiming a bow. And then what I'm calling the focus phase, he would say that's like releasing the arrow and the awareness penetrates the target. The arrow is the awareness in this case. And he would say that the meaning of satipatthana, which usually is translated in English as foundations of mindfulness, which I think is actually not what it means in Pali. I somewhat agree with Upandita. Upandita, who is, after all, a major Pali scholar, would say that patthana means to thrust the attention. Prasthana, or upasthana. It means that your awareness, is thrust up against the sensory event. Now, he asks you to do that. I give you the option, but I never require that because I've also found that that can get in the way. And some people, a lighter or even a more passive, just acknowledging it and that's fine, and I sort of let it focus me or whatever. Some people find a more passive stance during the focus phase works. Other people, hey, they like to shoot that dart and zap each sensory target and just dissolve it, okay? Whatever works. So options, when I say you can, never hear that as you must. So one thing you could do with this situation is you could sort of thrust the awareness more forcefully towards it. Sometimes that's how they interpret the word virya in Pali. Okay. Maybe you don't want to do that, or you do. Here's something else you can do. You can renote. In traditional Mahasi, actually everything is double noted. Lifting, lifting, swinging, swinging, treading, treading. So that you're actually technically double noting. I don't require that, but you can double note, but I also will allow you to triple note, or quad note, or note till gone. So you could. Once again, everyone here is crystal clear, right? Allowed doesn't mean have to. One thing you could do is say, if a sensory target presents itself, I will renote this 3 or 4 times. You set the quorum. I will stay with it unless it completely vanishes a certain number of times. I call that renoting. That's different from the stance, the active stance of thrusting. That's a decision, I'm going to stay with something a certain number of times, a certain acknowledge, focus, I'm going to quad note. Everything gets acknowledged and focused 4 times unless it completely vanishes before that. That will tend to slow things down and give you a little more quality experience with things. So those are a couple things you could do if you wanted to. And that's what I have to say about that. Okay, I think we have some questions back there.
Suppose I set a certain amount of time apart to meditate, let's say 40 minutes, and I select a certain focus range to start. If after a while I feel like changing, is it okay, or does it mean a lack of commitment, or shall I at the beginning of my time set what I want to do and stick to it, or is it okay to change after a while?
Okay, excellent question. I think everyone heard it. Once again, I'm only going to answer that question within the context of the way I like to formulate things, because other systems of practice may give you a very different answer, and there's a reason why they would give you a different answer. Because each system has its own organic wholeness. Each system of mindfulness is set up in a certain way so that all the elements work together. That's why you get opposite answers to certain questions. If you ask this teacher, they'll say, oh, absolutely do it this way. Ask this other teacher, well, absolutely do this, and it's the opposite answer. What's going on here? Well, what's going on is, within a certain framework, the best answer is A. But within a different framework, the best answer is not A. It's the opposite of A. So I will only answer this within the framework of my system. within my system, it's perfectly okay to switch your focuses during a given practices period. However, what you want to do is apply certain criteria. It's okay in theory, but here's my phrase, and it involves seven, count them. So sorry, okay, but it does cover the field. It's okay to change what you're focusing on and how you're focusing. Basically, any focus technique is broken down into those two dimensions. What am I focusing on? How am I focusing on it? It's okay to change both or either of those, as long as the change is motivated by interest, opportunity, and necessity, and or necessity, okay? Interest, you want to keep things interesting. Opportunity, sometimes significant stuff comes up that represents a window of opportunity. Let's explore it. Necessity, sometimes I want to focus on A, but guess what? B is too intense. I have to go to B. I just can't pull away from it. So my phrase is motivated by interest, opportunity, and necessity. You may choose what, you may change even in a given set what you're focusing on or how and or how you're focusing. However, the next three items, let it not be driven by, notice the contrast, motivated by versus driven by. Let your choices not be driven by craving, aversion, and unconsciousness. The three kleshas, if you're familiar with traditional Buddhism. In other words, if you're just bored, or you're like, oh, this is going to do it. Oh, no, no, that's not going to work. Oh, this is going to do it. Oh, no, no, that's not going to work. Oh, this is going to do it. Oh, no. You know, the samadhi is always deeper in some other sensory pasture, whatever. You know, been there, done that, okay? You don't want to be driven by carrots and sticks, cravings and aversions. You can be motivated legitimately by interest, opportunity, and necessity. Ion, like ion, charge particles. Move around, okay? Interest, opportunity, necessity. That's a geek joke. Sorry. Not driven by craving, aversion, and unconsciousness. Unconsciousness, you start out with mantra, you end up with breath counting, and you don't know where or why you changed. You were driven in an unconscious way to change your focus. No. And if it's like, oh, this is going to do it, no, that's not doing it. Oh, this is going to do it, no, that's not doing it. That's craving and aversion entering in. You don't want craving, aversion, and unconsciousness to drive those changes. You want the changes to be made very consciously and not on the basis of what I just said. So motivated by interest, opportunity, and necessity, fine. Driven by craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, not so fine. In terms of why you're changing and how you're changing your technique. Point number seven, biggest point of all, don't make a big deal about those decisions. Basically, we in daily life have a gazillion things to get all confused and obsessed with. In daily life, we have a gazillion things to be confused about and obsessed with. When we sit down to meditate, the only thing left to be confused about and obsessed with is how I'm going to meditate. So all those habits of confusion and obsession all get centered about what am I going to do? What's the best way to do? Am I doing this right? Am I doing this enough? Well, maybe this technique is what I need. Blah, 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 blah. And then you start to make a big deal about making these decisions. A much bigger deal than you should be making. Why? Because as far as I'm concerned, no matter what you're focusing on or how you're focusing, you're still developing the same core skills. One way or another, it always goes back to C, C, and E. Concentration, clarity, and equanimity. That's my unifying paradigm for all techniques worldwide. So once you realize that whatever your choice is, it's developing the same skill set. That disabuses you of some of this, like making a big deal out of the choices with regards to how to meditate. To repeat, in daily life, We have the habit of being confused and obsessed. But there's plenty of things that that habit can apply to, a gazillion things in life. Sit down to meditate, the only thing left to be confused about or obsessed about is how I'm going to meditate. And all that samskara just like goes towards the technique. That's why, so the biggest point is just don't make a big deal about such decisions. Motivated by interest, opportunity, necessity, not driven by craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, and don't make a big deal out of it. That's the most important point. Those are the guidelines. Within those guidelines, it's fine to change. Some teachers notice that people get so tripped out about how they're practicing that they refuse to teach any technique at all. Who is the most famous example of that kind of teacher? Absolutely, Krishnamurti. He saw all the problems that I just mentioned. His solution is don't give people any technique at all. That entails its own obvious problems. Yeah, you understand that. They all entail problems, and they're all attempts at solutions, and that's just the nature of the beast. So, enough about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess this might be on the same thing. Actually, you said enough about that, but I'll just quickly. Pain in practice. So you're saying don't let aversion move your practice. When we did the open, I had a surgery on the shoulder. I have a lower back issue. When we did the open, you know, any three of those focuses, pain was manageable. When we started to focus on each one, I found that when I was focusing on feeling, I didn't have the pain too bad because I could focus on it. But that when I was seeing or hearing, it was like I was out of my mind.
Yeah, the pain actually just, it was interestingly expanded as you turned away from it.
Right, right. So I'm going to put that under necessity. Am I cheating?
I'm not sure it's necessity, but you're definitely not cheating.
Okay.
Now, what you bring up is extremely interesting. And not surprisingly, has a broad framework within which it can be discussed. So, this is going to be a little bit of an extended answer. It's really not the same question, and it's actually a bundle of interesting questions.
Oh, good.
And I will... So, normally when we think of equanimity, we think of, if we think of it at all, which I hope you do, we tend to think of it as, well, it's the willingness to turn towards a certain sensory event. Like, okay, I'm willing to bring my attention to this perhaps gnarly thing. That is one half of equanimity. But there's another equanimity skill. It's the skill of saying, I'm willing to turn my attention away from this thing onto something else. Because, or you might think, well, if I'm turning my attention away from it, that's sort of denial or whatever. But actually, turning the attention towards it is, in a certain way, a coping mechanism, as you described. Because when you were focusing on the pain sensations themselves, just the act of focusing in some way made it manageable. When you turned your attention away from it, now whatever degree of control might have subliminally been present when you're turning towards, that's not there anymore. And so that thing can just do what it's going to do if you had no say in it. So sometimes when you turn away from something, it actually seems more untenable than when you're turning your attention towards it. Of course, the opposite also happens. Sometimes turning away from it sort of thins it out, and it makes it much easier to deal with it. So it could go either way. That's why I say there's actually two sides to equanimity. There's foreground equanimity, which is the ability to turn your attention towards something that may be difficult. And then there's background equanimity, which is the dimension of equanimity you're cultivating when you're turning your attention away from it and it's exploding and expanding like that. So you're actually learning something about equanimity by turning away from it in that case. So the good news is you have a choice. You can either turn towards, if you find that an easier way to work, that's okay. It's not cheating, as I will explain in a moment. Or you can turn away, deal with the consequence of that as best you can, and that's a legitimate training too. So this then goes to, remember I said it's not one question, it was a bundle of questions. So here's the second question that's woven into your question, which is, when should I bear down and when should I ease up? Big question, okay? Some teachers, it's all about bearing down. Rinzai Zen, hey, forget about it. It's all about bearing down. It's just, you just, it's white knuckle. It's just, you just sit there and you're in pain and you're in fatigue and all your emotions are erupting because you're being yelled at, maybe in, not here, but maybe in Japan, beaten. And every childhood rage and offense is, so your emotional body, you're totally disoriented. Perceptually, you're totally confused intellectually because the teacher's three times a day demanding that you show him or her your original face and you don't know WTF they're talking about. Everything is assailed. There's no button left unpushed 24/7. And you just auger through that shit to freedom or not. And you go to mindfulness and it works, hopefully. So that's like 100% bear down. Then you've got like the 100% ease up, just smile, breathe, and everything's going to take care of itself. Or even Krishnamurti, no technique at all. Not surprising, I'm going to say, well, there's a place for both approaches. And there's also a place for sort of working to a certain point, and then it's too much, and you're going to ease up. And then you work to the edge a little, you push it a little further, and then, hey, now this is too much, I'm going to ease up. This is my preferred strategy. Analogy, weightlifting. Once again, you don't have to bench press 300 kilos the first time in the gym, or maybe ever. But you will do enough reps against enough resistance to build some muscle. And then it's enough. And in fact, to do beyond that is actually not so productive. My phrase, work smart. So if it's not wimping out and it's not like cheating, if you push to a certain edge and then it's too much and you need to ease up now and take it easy, you learn as much from easing up as from bearing down, if you really know how to focus. So I would say explore both, but if one becomes untenable, you're not a child of a lesser God because you're working smart. You just gradually. I remember my teachers telling me things. I let's be sort of brutally honest about it. I had all my original training within a Asian context. Asian context means it's professional, okay? It's no nonsense. It's what you read about in the books. It's stuff we can all do as householders, but we may not be able to do it in just a couple years. In these monasteries, you learn how to do it in a couple years. For us, it may be a couple decades. We can get there, what we're living a householder's life. But they would say things like, hey, you're going to reach the point where you can break through pain. It doesn't matter. Your eyes are rolling up in your head. Your whole body is shaking uncontrollably. And you got a big smile on your face. It's all breaking up into flow. And they would tell me things like this. And I'm thinking, you know, what did you smoke this morning? Or what parallel universe are you from? You know, it's like, no way. But you know, they were right. But what I'll tell you, what was very helpful is one of my teachers, one of these people that sits 3 hours like 3 minutes, okay, like you've read about in the books, like classic mode, Chinese master. What he did say is, you gradually work up to it. Okay, you gradually work up to it. And that was very helpful, because it's like I didn't really see myself as getting there very quickly. But he said, you gradually work. So I pass that on to you. You gradually work your way up through that pain scale. But I am absolutely confident that in theory, there is no there's a limit as to how much pain the human nervous system can create. And the mindfulness can transcend that limit with enough practice. So there you go. I think clear answer, right? A little complicated, but we hit all the points. You're smiling. That's a pleasant feeling. I got it too. Yeah. Okay, maybe we'll take one more.
I guess I'm questioning my own reality, and I wanted to ask, through the years of meditation, teachers have all said, one sensation happens after another. Perhaps, say, feeling happens after a thought, but it's all one after another, and that's a way of untangling. And so with practice, I came to, I don't know, experience this, and now I disseminate this information to others. And I was surprised this morning about the car horn and the visual at the same time. And I didn't understand that. It did sort of interfere with my reality and my experience.
Well, you want to teach from your own experience, okay? So what you do is you ask yourself, regardless of what I may want to believe or what I've been told, what is my actual experience? Okay, can it be that while the sound is still lasting, a mental picture is also present in consciousness? Just look for yourself, rather than say it should be this way or that way. Go to your own experience. And see for yourself. And then teach based on what you actually experience. I cannot give a confident answer to your question. I can give an answer based on my own sensory experience, but a truly the implied question you're asking is, are there truly simultaneous sensory events or not? Okay. Why can I not give you a confident answer? I believe that that is a science question, not a meditation question, so to speak. And science can't answer that question yet. In other words, it is possible that the shifting of attention within the nervous system is such that, in fact, there is only one arising at any given instant. That is possible. However, I would imagine that that shift must take place awful quick. And I'm not sure that that you can consciously detect events that quick. So it is possible. It is, however, well known that one of the characteristic features of the human nervous or any nervous system is parallel processing. In fact, it's one of the things that distinguishes a neural network, which is what we are, from a standard von Neumann computer, which, unless it's got parallel processors, just runs linearly. So we do know that circuits co-activate. There's not a scintilla of doubt that visual, auditory, and somatic are being simultaneously processed by the brain. In terms of how that comes about with sensory experience. I would say that go with what you actually experience. When you look objectively, see what's there, and then work and teach based on what you've experienced. This is what the Buddha himself said. I would say that, in other words, when people came to the Buddha, it's like, okay, how do we know what to teach? Shall we teach what you teach? He basically said, teach what agrees with your own experience and what agrees with logic and evidence. So, you know, see for your ehi pasiko, see for yourself. However, even if you've got a co-occurrence, here's a good example. We've all had the experience of being righteously upset about something emotionally, right? Anyone not had that experience? Well, then you're another species. if something's really got your goat, or if you really, really want something badly, there's an intense urging, I think if you look carefully, you'll see there's simultaneous image, talk, and emotional body. However, here's the thing. Even though there's all three at once, they do erupt as a single occurrence, okay? That there is one envelope that surrounds that eruption of see, hear, feel. And when that envelope collapses, that eruption of see, hear, feel vanishes. So it still is only happening one thing at a time, but the thing may be very complicated. But if you've got good mindfulness, the whole wave, even though it covers the whole inner world of activation, that whole wave will be a single wave that arises and passes individually. So you are one way or another into an experience of a sequence of moments that have their own beginnings and own endings. My thing is that some of those moments are not just one sense gate. They're more complex. But absolutely, and I suppose the reasons some teachers talk and make a little bit of a big deal about individual arisings is that as your practice matures, your experience does tend to converge to a sequence of, quote, mind moments that arise, pass. I'm just saying some of those mind moments might be a little more complex than just one sense element. So that's what I have to say about that. Okay, so now we're going to stay in silence, but we're going to have a chance to move around a little bit, use washrooms, stretch, keep silence, keep a technique going of your choice. 5-10 minutes, feel a little better, come back, have a final practice period. Once again, take a moment to stretch up and settle in. The face goes smooth. The jaw releases. The shoulders drop. The arms hang limp and loose. The legs may have some pressure on them, but they don't have to work. The anti-gravity muscles can relax. And the core muscles, the diaphragm, and the muscles between the ribs mostly relax on the out-breath. The whole body hangs limp and loose, and the central pillar is maintained erect through alignment and balance, not so much effort. This is asana, sthiram sukham asanam, stable and comfortable. That's the definition of asana, the Yoga Sutras. We've explored four possible focus ranges, three restricted, one unrestricted. It's all good. So you have four choices of what. And with the see, hear, feel technique, you have two choices about how. You can use mental labels or just direct awareness. Based on interest, opportunity, necessity, hopefully not driven by craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, decide what and how you'd like to focus for the next few minutes, our last period. Ride on the momentum of the good work we've done. It's possible that as the result of our day of practice, you're experiencing tranquility or energy or increase in emotional well-being, pleasant emotional sensation. It's not guaranteed that such reward flavors will be present, but sometimes they are, and if they are, tuning into it, staying with it, one or a combination. As you transition from practice in stillness to life, that can help inform life with the effects of the practice. It's possible that you may be able to taste in a tangible way a state of concentration or heightened clarity or the gentle matter-of-factness that we call equanimity. Those are the tastes of mindful awareness, an acquired taste. The sign of a mature spiritual palate, so to speak. If any of that is present, that's another thing we can tune into and stay with in life. Okay, good. Excellent work, folks. And we shall continue tomorrow. Just a couple FYI things. What you experienced today is actually just part of an overall system. It's the part that involves observing type practices. Basically, if you look worldwide, you could analyze all focusing methods in terms of four basic strategies. Some methods involve observing, that's what we did today. Some methods involve creating. For example, you have loving kindness practice, where you're nurturing, creating, reinforcing positive directions in terms of emotion and so forth. But it can be broader than that. I somewhat generalize the loving kindness into something I call nurture positive, where you're attempting to foster positive directions in terms of the ABCs of being a good human being. The ABCs are affect, which is emotion, behavior, which is obvious what it is, what we do in the world, and cognition, which is rational or adaptive thinking. So some strategies are passive observing, some strategies are active creating. Then you have questioning strategies, where you ask a question, Zen koans, also part of Zen, but also part of Hinduism, is what's called self-inquiry, where you sort of ask, who am I? You press that question back. You try to have consciousness, observe consciousness kind of thing. So those are sort of questioning or self-inquiry approaches. And then there are the meditations that are not meditations. You might say that's oxymoronic. How can a meditation not be a meditation? But it's the do-nothing approach, just sitting, or certain aspects of Dzogchen, where you drop all investment in control, and sort of it's a do-nothing. I call it do-nothing. Sometimes in Tibetan, Dzogchen is called gome, which means non-meditating. Then you might say, well, how is that different from monkey mind? Well, read my section on do-nothing to find out the difference. So basically, when you look around the world in terms of how to focus really broad strategic decisions, you can observe, you can actively create, you can question, push back, ask, or you can do nothing in a very special way so that it's not just wasting your time. So in any event, just to give you the big picture of things, I incorporate three of those four into basic mindfulness. So today we did observing, and that's what we're going to do tomorrow, just to get some momentum. But it's not like I never have people do loving kindness. And I also give people the option of sort of dropping all technique and doing the technique that's not the technique. I don't typically teach self-inquiry, although I think it's a fantastic practice, and you can go on YouTube and hear me talk about my own experiences with it and so forth. Just my system's already too complicated, so I just couldn't put that in the grab bag, although I'd like to, but it already is top heavy. So I just didn't want you to get the wrong idea that this is all I ever teach people. Affect behavior and intentional, rational, adaptive cognition are big themes also, but that's a whole other way of working. One-stop shopping for resources is the website basicmindfulness.org. That's my main website. On the front page of that website, you'll find the links to my YouTube channels, which are extensive, and I'm very proud to say have high production values. They're easy to watch. And there's God knows how many segments there, and they're organized into playlists by topic. So it's very convenient. I've got a pretty extensive blog, a gazillion free articles you can reach from there, and something called the Home Practice Program. You don't have to travel to do retreats with me. My retreats every month, the second weekend of the month, we broadcast over the, bring to you via conference call into your home. Live retreats, typically with me, in very manageable four-hour modules. You can check that out. That's called the Home Practice Program. So it's very easy and very cheap and very convenient. So those are some of the many resources that are either free or virtually free. It's all at that one website, basicmindfulness.org. So just wanted to say that. That's it for me. Is there anything the center would like to end with? And then we'll be done.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.